The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
Hey, it's a joy to be with you guys tonight again. Kind of pick up in a little sense of kind of where we left off from last night. There's a parable that David Foster Wallace opened. He gave a famous commencement speech at Kenyon College, and he opens it with this little parable that I think is a helpful starting place. He says, "There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, 'Morning, boys, how's the water?' And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, 'What the heck is water?'" It's one of those funny little stories that's both cliched and profoundly true. And it's a story that reminds us of how important I think the questions that we're asking this weekend really are. The truth is that the world around us, that the world that surrounds us shapes us in a profound way. And we're often totally unconscious of it. We're often like these fish swimming along in water, unaware of the fact that we're swimming in water. The truth is that being connected to culture and shaped by culture is not something that's optional. We can't avoid it. And I say this as somebody who grew up in the church where the church had a Christian subculture that was intended to exist as a way to avoid getting entangled and shaped and formed too much by culture. So instead of, you could have your Christian t-shirts and your Christian music and your Christian novels and your Christian entertainments. But yet, the fact that we were buying, looking for ways to sort of display who we are and find a sense of identity in shopping, in buying certain products and wearing and displaying them, is a sure sign that the culture's already got us, right? We're already being formed and shaped. We've already been formed and shaped. So it's not a question of do we have culture and are we influenced by culture, but it's a question of how is it shaping and influencing us and what options and tools are available to us to undo some of that work. To use the language we've been using about cultural liturgies, it's not a matter of whether we'll be shaped by stories and liturgies. It's a question of choosing which stories and liturgies will allow to shape us. And so what I want to talk about tonight is the world that we're actually living in. The title of this is Enchantment, Abundance, and the Strange World of Worship. What is the world in which we're attempting to have a relationship with God and connect with Him and worship Him? And I want to start out by talking about the fact that for the vast majority of our lives, the vast majority of the stories that we tell and the liturgies that we're involved in, that prime us to live in a world where God's presence isn't necessarily ruled out, but is made superfluous. This wasn't always the case. Once upon a time, it was nearly impossible to talk about things like science or nature or how the world worked or relationships between people without in some way talking about God, talking about His involvement. God was seen as a creator, the gods, or God was seen as a creator and a caretaker who gave sense and meaning and order to the world. Today, the exact opposite is the case. It's hard, in our world at large, it's hard to talk about nature or astronomy or even ethics and bring up the name of God unless you want to be ruled out completely. That's the water we swim in, a world where the presence of God in a broad, public, everyday life has been crowded out. And the word that that Jamie Smith and Charles Taylor and a sociologist named Max Weber have all used to describe this world is that it's disenchanted. And that's a perfect moment to actually plug Jamie's book over there, A Secular Age, a book that talks a lot about this and I think is really helpful. The idea of disenchantment is that in the generations over the last 400 or 500 years, Western culture has grown increasingly suspicious of transcendence, of the supernatural explanations for the world got pushed out as we discovered through inquiry how the world works. So when we no longer have, the fact that the sun rises is no longer a mystery. The way diseases work is no longer a mystery. We have answers to these questions where in the past those questions would have been answered with some kind of supernatural resource, some sort of story or some sort of myth or legend that gave us a supernatural explanation for the world. I love the way Hannah Arendt describes this undoing of the world because what it leads to is a certain hubris. She says that the telescope gave us the illusion of mastery over the stars and the microscope gave us the illusion of mastery over minutiae. We think we've understand the way the world works, and she believes that that's what puts the world itself at risk. Transcendence, belief in God, belief in spirituality in general, was crowded out of our culture as we found answers for the questions about how the world works. Prior to this, as Taylor talks about, the world was enchanted. In this world, belief in God, spirituality, the transcendent was the norm, part of the background of every conversation. People believed they were vulnerable to evil spirits and to the gods and to blessings and to curses. The world was mysterious. One example of this, or one way to look at how this changed, is that in this previous era, people saw themselves as living in a cosmos, a world that was created by a God that had a sense of order, where relationships between the elements of nature had a sense and had a purpose, where history had meaning and had a direction. And God's presence guaranteed that in a cosmos. But today, of course, we live in a universe. We live in a universe where everything's random and meaningless and devoid of purpose. Charles Taylor talks about this, and he says that this shift in the world, the shift in the way that we see things and we experience life, didn't just happen. He says it was a struggle and an achievement to get where we are in a secular age. And in some respects, this achievement is fragile. We know this because each one of us, as we grew up, has had to take on the disciplines of disenchantment. And we regularly reproach each other for our failings in this regard. We accuse each other of magical thinking, of indulging in myth, of giving away to fantasy. We say that X isn't living in our century, or that Y has a medieval mind, while Z, whom we admire, is way ahead of her time. What he's talking about are these sort of disenchantment narratives, narratives that where we talk about how the world isn't magical, doesn't have meaning, doesn't have a purpose, and we talk ourselves into looking at the world this way. Or to put it the other way around, we have learned to talk ourselves out of looking for meaning and depth and transcendence in the world at large. I love that. A great example of this is something that Louis C.K. said. He was on the Conan O'Brien show. And he was talking about why he didn't want his kids to have cell phones. And he says, underneath everything in your life, there's that thing, that empty, forever empty, that knowledge that it's all for nothing and you're alone. It's down there. And sometimes when things get clear away and you're not watching anything and you're in your car and you start going, oh no, here it comes, that I'm alone, it starts to visit on you. Just this sadness. Life is tremendously sad just by being in it. That's why we text and drive. I look around and pretty much 100% of the people driving are texting, and they're killing. Everybody's murdering each other with their cars. But people are willing to take this risk. People are willing to risk taking a life and ruining their own because they don't want to be alone for a second because it's so hard. The key thing to notice here is that Louis doesn't want his kids to have cell phones because he wants them to be strong enough to face life's emptiness, meaninglessness, and sadness. That's a disenchantment narrative. That's the world we live in where it's brave and bold to say everything is meaningless, it has no value, there's no eternal purpose. Once you're dead, you stay dead. And the important thing for us to hear tonight is that disenchantment, this world, doesn't just affect unbelievers. It's the world that we've all been immersed in for all of our lives. And it causes our faith, our practice of our faith, to become difficult and complex and troubled. Taylor says this, he says, I am never or only rarely really sure, free of all doubt, untroubled by some objection, by some experience which won't fit. We can't help looking over our shoulder from time to time, looking sideways, living our faith also in the condition of doubt and uncertainty. I don't know about you, but when I read those words, I was like, I completely identify with that. Completely identify with that sense of my faith always having this sense of struggle, of trouble, of difficulty. Disenchantment has profound effects on the way we approach our faith in a world where transcendence really isn't allowed. The Christian life becomes something like everything else that we have to break down with scientific analysis. We have to break it into component parts and try to figure it out. To put it a little differently, the water we're swimming in is disenchanted and we don't even know that it's happening. We're so immersed in the disciplines of disenchantment, so surrounded by stories and liturgies that drain the world of a sense of mystery and transcendence, that we're primed to be suspicious even of our own faith. I remember a few years ago, my parents' church opened a new facility, and this is a massive mega church in Louisville. And during the service, there was like a special music moment where a guy's singing a solo. And as the music starts, they dim all the lights, and there's a spotlight on him. And about maybe a third of the way through the song, this cross on the wall starts to glow. And to be clear, this cross is probably like 3 stories tall. And this light starts to glow out from behind the cross. And as the song builds and goes on, like he gets towards the bridge and it gets bigger and brighter and brighter. And then as he's singing the final choruses, it's like blinding bright. So bright, overwhelmingly bright. And, you know, it was just a moment in the service and I didn't think much of it. But at lunch afterwards, I was talking with my dad and he was like, he was really moved by the song and by that moment. And he goes, and how about that light from the cross? And I was like, yeah, that was pretty intense. And he goes, do you think it was real? Right? And I just laughed. Like, no, like Jeff, the AV guy, he's just got the dimmer, right? He's, you know. But I've been haunted by that story. I've been haunted by that experience because I realized like there wasn't even a shadow of doubt in my head, right? I just instantly respond, of course not. That would be ridiculous. And yet, we're talking about a worship service and we're talking about, is it possible that God made the cross glow? And I'm talking about a God who I believe wholeheartedly that in this book of stories that talks about a God who raises the dead and who heals the sick and who makes the sun stand still and makes donkeys talk. I mean, some pretty bizarre things are capable of happening in this world if God wants to make them happen. And yet I'm so primed, like probably like most of you, that when my dad goes, do you think it was real? I'm just like, that's ridiculous. Of course not. Well, what I want to do tonight is sort of open a window into another way of seeing the world, a way of seeing the world that I think is sort of a throwback. I want to pull out what I'll call an enchanted relic. It's a story that comes from an age before disenchantment had taken a hold of our culture. And it's an old Scottish folktale about 3 daughters who were sent out to make their way in the world. And it's a little strange. So I give you the story of the girl and the dead man. I'm just going to read it. Once upon a time, there was an old woman, and she had a leash of daughters. One day, the eldest daughter said to her mother, it's time for me to go into the world and seek my fortune. I shall break a loaf of bread for you to carry with you, said the mother. When the bread came from the oven, the mother asked her daughter, would you rather have a small piece in my blessing or a large piece in my curse? I would rather have the large piece in your curse, replied the daughter. Off she went down the road, and when night came wreathing round her, she sat at the foot of a wall to eat her bread. A ground quail and her 12 puppies gathered near, and the little birds of the air. Will you give us a piece of their bread? They asked. I won't, you ugly brutes, she replied. I haven't enough for myself. My curse on thee, said the quail, and the curse of my 12 birds, and thy mother's curse, which is the worst of all. The girl arose and went on her way, and the piece of bread had not been half enough. She had not traveled far before she saw a little house, and though it seemed a long way off, she soon found herself before its door. She knocked and heard a voice cry out, who's there? A good maid, seeking a master. We need that, said the voice, and the door swung open. The girl's task was to stay awake every night and watch over a dead man, the brother of the housewife, whose corpse was restless. As her reward, she was to receive a peck of gold and a peck of silver. And while she stayed, she was to have as many nuts as she broke, as many needles as she lost, as many thimbles as she pierced, and as much thread as she used, as many candles as she burned, a bed of green silk over her, and a bed of green silk under her, sleeping by day and watching by night. On the very first night, however, she fell asleep in her chair. The housewife came in, struck her with a magic club, killed her dead, and threw her out in the pile of garbage. Soon thereafter, the middle daughter said to her mother, it's a cheery tale, right? Soon thereafter, the middle daughter said to her mother, it's time for me to follow my sister and seek my fortune. Her mother baked her a loaf of bread, and she too chose the larger piece in her mother's curse. And what had happened to her sister happened to her as well. Soon thereafter, the youngest daughter said to her mother, it's time for me to follow my sisters and seek my fortune. I had better bake you a loaf of bread, said her mother. Which would you rather have, a small piece in my blessing or a large piece in my curse? I would rather, said the daughter, have the smaller piece and your blessing. So she set off down the road, and when night came wreathing around her, she sat at the foot of a wall to eat her bread. The ground quail and her 12 puppies and the little birds of the air gathered and asked, will you give us a piece of that? I will, you pretty creatures, if you will keep me company. She shared her bread. All of them ate their fill, and the birds clapped their wings about her till she was snug and with warmth. The next morning she saw a house the long way off, and here the task and the wages were repeated. So she sat up at night to watch the corpse, sewing to pass the time. About midnight, the dead man sat up and screwed up a grin. If you don't lie down properly, I will give you 1 good leathering with the stick, she cried. He lay down. After a while, he rose up on one elbow and screwed up a grin. And a third time, he sat and screwed up a grin. When he rose the third time, she walloped him with the stick. The stick stuck to the dead man, and her hand stuck to the stick. And off they went. He dragged her through the woods, and when it was too high for him, it was too low for her. And when it was too low for him, it was too high for her. The nuts were knocking their eyes, and the wild plums beat at their ears until they both got through the wood. Then they returned home. The girl was given the peck of gold, the peck of silver, and a vessel of cordial. She found her two sisters, and she rubbed them with the cordial, and it brought them back to life. And they left me sitting here, and if they were well, 'tis well. And if they were not, let them be. So let's see Disney make that one into a cartoon, right? I think perhaps the most important thing to say at the outset here is that I could probably have read any one of 1,000 folk tales. The point's not to exegete this particular one, because this one happens to be particularly true, though in many ways I think it is, but to hear this folktale as a witness to another way of seeing the world. Lewis Hyde writes about this tale in a book called The Gift, and the tale was originally found in a collection that was published in the early 1800s called Folk Tales of the Scottish Highlands, and it's probably much, much, much older even than that. Hyde is interested in this story, and he talks about it in his book, The Gift, because Hyde's a poet, and he's trying to understand how creativity works in the world. And what he essentially begins to argue in this book is he begins to argue, you know, creativity isn't something that you can dissect. Creativity isn't something that it seems like something that we don't have a whole lot of control over. It sort of appears when it wants to appear in the world, and then it seems to disappear. So what are the principles of creativity? How can we bear witness to it taking place, you know? So for instance, some people will work their whole lives at making music, and they may write one good song. And then some people are named Paul McCartney. In a way, I think Hyde is arguing for an understanding of the world that's enchanted, that there's more to the world than what we can see, what we can measure, what we can test for. Hyde sees this reality in this folktale, in the story, and he unpacks it with these gifts. So what Hyde says is this. He says, when the first gift comes along, the mother's not merely offering bread. She's really offering herself. And that this is the way gifts work. That the way we receive a gift is as important as the gift itself, because a gift is something that forms and affirms bonds. So to the oldest daughter, she says, "Do you want more bread and my curse, or less bread and my blessing?" And they choose the curse. They choose the more bread and the curse. And the mindset here is, what's a curse going to do to me? I don't need your blessing. That doesn't help me. I need the bread because I have to go set out in the world. I need to get all that I can for myself. They make a practical, pragmatic, and reasonable decision. They don't think they're vulnerable to spiritual consequences. The younger daughter responds to this invitation with sensitivity to the spiritual consequences of relationships. She believes she's vulnerable, and she essentially says, "Look, I'd rather have you than the bread. There's more to life than bread," or as someone else once said, "Man doesn't live on bread alone." The second gift that we see in the story is the encounter with the birds. The older daughters are still being practical. They're still being pragmatic. They're being perfectly reasonable, and they don't share the bread because they don't have enough, and they need to save all that they can for their journey. The younger daughter, again, still sensitive to spiritual consequences and relationships, shares what she has, shares the little bit that she has. She believes she's vulnerable. And then the consequences of this is that because the older daughters, they don't share the bread, and somehow the bread that they do have doesn't fill them up, so they don't rest, they don't get any sleep, and they show up at the dead man's house, and they're tired, and they're unable to stay awake through the night, and they die. The younger daughter shares what she has, and because there's a sense in her story that the world is a place of abundance. That what's important is not merely what we see and what we have, what we can collect, but that the world is an abundant place, and I need to act accordingly. So she does, and the world responds by essentially blessing her. And I think that this is an interesting place to begin to ask some questions about, is the world enchanted or is the world disenchanted? Do we live in a universe or do we live in a cosmos? In a universe, what you see is what you get, and there's wisdom in hoarding what you have for yourself. In a cosmos, everything's overseen by a God who stewards and cares for creation, and what you have isn't simply yours. What you have is meant to be used for the purposes God declares for it, to be received as a gift and shared as a gift. The fact is that generosity only makes sense in a cosmos where bread for today and bread for tomorrow are ultimately out of our hands, but in the hands of our Creator. The younger daughter sees the world this way. She believes in abundance. She believes in abundance, and the world proves itself to be abundant because she has enough. She has enough to not only survive and do what's do the tasks that are before her, but to actually resurrect her sisters, to bring life where there was death. The final gifts in the story are the gift of the cordial that she's given after she gets back from being dragged through the woods. And I have no idea what that whole part about being dragged through the woods means. I have no clue. But she's given this gift. She endures the trial and she's given this gift. And then she, what does she do? She turns around and extends the gift to others. She gives it to her sisters and brings life where there was death. I think if we wrote this tale as a moral tale today in a disenchanted world, it would go something like this. The older daughters would be the ones that took less bread and the blessing because they were being superstitious and foolish. They'd share the bread with the birds and they'd probably die of starvation in the wilderness. The younger daughter would take more bread and the curse. She'd probably kill and roast the pigeons and eat them by the wall. And she'd take the job of sitting over the dead man. She'd roll her eyes about the idea of this thing being restless because we know that dead people stay dead. She'd sit up all night reading Twitter on her cell phone and not worry about the dead guy. And then she'd appear as a guest on the Dave Ramsey show commending her for her shrewdness. The moral would be, don't get fooled by superstition. See, I think this story is warning us of the consequences of disenchantment, of believing that we're not vulnerable spiritually, that the world is only what we can see and what we can measure. And it's interesting when you compare this vision of the world with the vision of the world in the scriptures. Paul, quoting Jesus, tells us that it's more blessed to give than receive. There's the story of the widow's mite that tells us that her gift was greater, her gift was more valuable than all the gifts of the other people, even though it was a smaller gift. She gave all she had. Same goes with the story of the rich young ruler, or even more interesting, the story of Exodus 20, the manna in the wilderness, where every morning Israel is supposed to wake up and know that God is going to give them the bread they need for the day. They should only take what they need for the day. If they take too much, if they try to hoard it and grab it because they're worried that God's not going to show up tomorrow and take care of them, then what they grab, what they take, it turns to rot. Somehow the world is more magical, more enchanted, more mysterious than we think it is. Sorry. There's more to the world than the surfaces, and there's more to the world than what appears. It may be that the world of the girl and the dead man is more true to reality than the disenchanted narratives that we've heard, repeated, embodied, and practiced, and believed at the deepest level of our hearts. As a result, I think many of us have a disenchanted approach to faith. We approach it like scientists. We're looking for formulas that will give us the results that we want. Pastors are guilty of it too. While none of us would ever plan a worship service and say out loud, God won't show up to work in our hearts, we might nonetheless plan the thing so that God's work is superfluous for the results. We might manipulate emotions through music and sentimental prayers and sermons so that we get so that you feel thrilled while you're there. Likewise, congregations might be guilty of the same thing. Bart Simpson once described contemporary worship experiences as lights, smoke, and Tybo. Now that only thrives though, because Christians are satisfied by it. We are, as C.S. Lewis might say, too easily pleased. Functionally, I think disenchantment makes us into what Dallas Willard calls biblical deists. He tells us that biblical deists believe that God essentially wound up the world like a clock, set it spinning, and gave us an instruction manual, the Bible, to figure out what we're supposed to do in this world without him. The Christian life is spent trying to figure out what the manual means. Now I want to ask the question though, how would it change things if we actually begin to expect that God would show up, that God would be present in our gatherings and in our lives? How do you respond when you hear about someone being miraculously healed? If you hear a story of a healing, what's your gut reaction? Do you feel awkward and uncomfortable when conversations turn spiritual in public? Or when somebody starts talking to you about spiritual warfare or demon possession or charismatic gifts? I think all of us have a certain level of discomfort about those conversations. And I think we need to be aware that this is how disenchantment's affected us. Whether we're talking about a worship service or personal devotions, we often don't expect God to show up. We think that we're on our own. And if we're on our own, we need strategies and plans we need spectacular events to go from one to the next, to keep our hearts thrilled, to keep us attached. If we're on our own, we don't actually need any real spiritual vitality. We can just figure out how to sort of work the system. We don't actually need a life of prayer because that feels like we're talking to a blank wall and there's so much work to be done. Again, I don't think these are conscious thoughts and ideas, but I think that they're simmering somewhere deep under the surface because we've absorbed these stories. And the truth is, if we're honest, I as a pastor have experienced this, that most of the people who I talk to have a deep dissatisfaction. We struggle to pray. We struggle to come face to face with God, and we long for it. Most of us, and certainly most of our most of us are like the older daughters. We're unaware and unconvinced of our spiritual vulnerability. We walk around and we say, "Give me the bread. Look, I just need the bread." And I don't want to stretch the metaphor too far here, but ask yourself, what's the bread you're after, right? What's the thing that you're after when you think about your spiritual life? Would we rather have effective parenting techniques or a relationship with the living God? Would we rather have a happy, easy marriage or a God who meets us in the midst of our struggling, failing marriages? Would we rather have money and a bigger house and a better job or a God who meets us in poverty, homelessness, and unemployment? A lot of us want bread and the curse. We want our pain ended because we're convinced that God isn't actually going to show up. And as scary as that idea is, here's an idea that's even bigger and scarier. What if we really aren't alone? What if God isn't some disinterested deity out there, but's active, living, and present? What if, as Paul said, we're living, moving, and having our being in him? What if worship isn't something we do at a specific time and place on a mountain or in the temple, but something that happens in spirit and truth? What if God's word really does dwell in us richly as we sing songs together? What if it's true that his word is light and life and living water and has the power to raise people from the dead? What if we're vulnerable to evil and darkness and principalities and powers, demons and devils who want to kill, steal, and destroy everything that's good in our lives? Because that's the real world. That's the world that we live in. We don't live in a world that's disenchanted. We live in a world that's no different than, as Karl Barth once described it, the strange world of the Bible. A world of spirits and miracles and angels and demons and donkeys that talk. Dead men that get up and walk. That's the real world. And that's the world that we testify to every time the church gathers and says that Christ has died and Christ has risen and Christ will come again. So how do we live in that world? How do we begin to reframe and reimagine the world that we're living in? I think there's a couple of things that we need. We need disciplines and we need an awakening. I think there's an extent to which the following statement's true, that we've disciplined ourselves into this situation with disciplines of disenchantment, with stories and narratives and ideas that have been repeated throughout our lives that have caused us to think of the world in this way. Likewise, we need to discipline our way out of it. Dallas Willard once said that grace isn't opposed to effort, it's opposed to earning. And he talks about that in the light of the spiritual discipline, saying we need to plan for our lives, plan for the ways that our lives are going to be reshaped, restructured, reordered, the new lenses we're going to put on the world. We need to plan for that, and we need to practice it. We need to cultivate practices that shape our daily life in a way that enables us to inhabit the world differently by deliberately replacing these habits and disciplines of disenchantment with spiritual disciplines. We learn to inhabit the world in a different way. Habit itself and repetitive practices themselves are something that we actually have a really hard time with now because we don't like repetition. We don't necessarily believe in repetition. We don't think that it's a good thing. Matthew Milliner, writing about disenchantment, writes this. He says, "Habit was once understood as synderesis, the benevolent patterns that imbue intelligence and free the mind for contemplation. In a secular age, these become mindless repetition." We look at doing the same thing the same way over and over again in our lives as being problematic, and that we're addicted to the new. We want a new way of doing things, a new and exciting thing. But it's a mistake to think that repetition itself is vain. We need to ask if habit, meaningful habit especially, might not be necessary for a meaningful spontaneity and all of life spirituality. Liturgies are repetitive, and that's a good thing. It's a habit that serves as a way so that we can inhabit a new world. Worship and spiritual disciplines are habits and practices that we take in order to inhabit the world in a new way. And because worship is a way of experiencing the world as enchanted, we don't just tell a better story through music, liturgy, word, spirit, bread, and wine. God shows up and ministers to his people in ways that you can't plan for or explain or account for or measure. So how do we know that God will show up? I think the temptation that exists for worship leaders, and I say this as a tempted worship leader, is to manipulate the process. There's a way of crafting an emotional worship service, of tugging at heartstrings for a couple of hours, and in the end, when everybody is emotionally moved and stirred, we say, look what God did. In reality, they had a similar experience that they could have had at a movie or a concert. So I think as pastors and worship leaders, we need to recognize that we too often settle for imminence. And the same thing's true for us as worshipers. We settle for those emotive experiences. John Whitfield said this. He says, the Spirit's presence is always a gift. It can never be engineered or produced. When we fall into these temptations, we alternate between quenching the Spirit and grieving the Spirit. The point is that we need to be aware of the fact that what we're asking for as we begin to reorder our lives, as we begin to try to reimagine how we're living in this world, as we begin to take on habits and disciplines, we don't just need the habits and disciplines. We actually need God to show up. We need the Spirit's presence in our lives to be completely transforming who we are and how we see the world. That's something we can't engineer. We can't fake. If you want to break through disenchantment, you don't need a better strategy. You don't need a better band. You don't need better gifts. You don't need better skills. We need way more than that. You need a miracle. You need an awakening. And only the Holy Spirit can do that. There's a church historian named Larry Hurtado, and one of the things he points out is that in the early practices of the church, the early church existed in the midst of a religious culture that was really vibrant. There was Roman religion, there was Judaic religion, and both of those religions were very visual. There was a lot of visual stuff that went on. There was a lot of ceremony. There was a lot of massive feasts and celebrations. And yet the church gathered without any sort of official rituals, without a whole lot of visual stuff going on. They gathered around the word, the simplicity of the word. And he says that's intentional. He says, and I think the lesson that we can take away from that is that we don't need our skills with the word more to be more spectacular than all these alternatives. Because the power isn't in the skills. The power isn't in the fact that we can put on a good show. The power is in the fact that when you open the word of the Lord speaks. So what do we need? I think we need to just keep showing up. Woody Allen says 88% of success is just showing up. I think that what we need is we need to discern what are the habits, what are the practices, what are the new ways of inhabiting God's world so that our lenses can be transformed and the way that we see it can change. We need to keep showing up, keep doing the work, keep shining the light on the things that God gets most excited about, keep choosing these better stories, and trust that God will do the heavy lifting of rewriting our hearts. Thank you.